isolated. Their experiences and training have led them to think differently about what it means to plan, to evaluate risk, and to define problems in the first place. As a result, they frequently talk past each other, using the same words to mean quite different things. If any civilian-military gap matters, it is this one. Cultural or opinion gaps between the general public and the military community are media fodder, but there is little evidence that they cause actual harm. The mistrust and mutual ignorance that often characterize relations between high-level civilian and military decision-makers is another story. Here, misunderstandings and mistrust can lead to arbitrary decisions and do genuine harm both to the military and to U.S. interests. During my time serving in civilian jobs at the Pentagon and the State Department, I watched numerous interagency discussions devolve into exercises in mutual misunderstanding and frustration. Some of these discussions, such as Pentagon-White House squabbling over troop levels in Afghanistan and the split-the-baby outcome, made headlines. Others never came close to registering in the public consciousness, but rankled those involved. The wrong civilian. Take a small but typical example. In the spring of 2010, a minor crisis unfolded in Kyrgyzstan. Several hundred people were killed by police and ethnically aligned mobs, many more were wounded, and thousands of refugees, mostly from Kyrgyzstan's Uzbek minority population, fled their homes. Within the White House, these events triggered fears of a possible ethnic cleansing campaign to come, or even genocide. At the time, I was still serving at the Pentagon, and one day I received a call from a member of the White House's national security staff. With little preamble, he told me that Central Command needed to move a surveillance platform to a position from which it could monitor fast-breaking events in Kyrgyzstan. This was a creative and interesting idea. Drones and other intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets have the potential to be powerful tools in human rights monitoring. The ability to watch troops or mobs or refugees move in real time, to see weapons being stockpiled or mass graves being filled, could potentially help the United States take timely and appropriate action to stop a genocide before it gets off the ground. Why not put drones to work for the cause of human rights? But there was one big problem with my White House colleague's request. Neither one of us had any authority to order Central Command to immediately shift a potentially vital asset from wherever it was currently being used to the skies over Kyrgyzstan. I asked the obvious question. Had the president discussed this with the Secretary of Defense? "We don't have time to spin up a whole bureaucratic process," he responded. "The president doesn't want another Rwanda. This is a top priority of his. I need you to just communicate this to CENTCOM and get this moving." But the chain of command doesn't go from a White House staffer to an advisor to the Undersecretary of Defense to U.S. Central Command. And the military doesn't put drones into foreign airspace without a great deal of planning, an enormous amount of legal advice, and the right senior officials signing off on the whole idea. Where would this drone come from? What was it doing now, and what tasks would it be unable to take on if it was shifted to Kyrgyzstan? Which personnel would control it from what airbase in what country? Whose airspace would it fly over? What budget would support the shift? What would the political consequences be if it fell or was shot down? Exactly where would it go? What precisely would it be looking for? Who would receive and analyze any imagery or other intelligence it gathered? How long would it stay? And so on. My White House colleague was incredulous when I raised some of these concerns. "We're talking about, like, one drone. You're telling me you can't just call some colonel at CENTCOM and make this happen? Why the hell not? You guys," by which he meant the Pentagon writ large, "are always stonewalling us on everything. I'm calling you from the White House. The president wants to prevent genocide in Kyrgyzstan. Whatever happened to civilian control of the military?" He, I had to explain, was the wrong civilian. It was a minor issue, but the exchange was far from unusual. My White House colleague, a smart, energetic, dedicated guy, went away upset, convinced that the military was refusing to take atrocity prevention issues seriously, an attitude that soured many later interagency discussions about Sudan, Libya, Syria, and more. My military colleagues reacted to the request, when I relayed it, with equal irritation. How could a senior White House official fail to understand why the military could not, in fact, fight two major land wars, stop terrorists and pirates all over the world, foster economic development in Africa, stop human trafficking, and monitor and prevent atrocities in Kyrgyzstan using drones all at the same time. They were appalled that a White House official seemed not to understand that sensitive, expensive military assets couldn't instantly be moved from a war zone to foreign airspace via a simple phone call from a mid-level staffer at the National Security Council to a Pentagon acquaintance. If the president wanted to make this happen, he could call the defense secretary and direct him to have CENTCOM undertake such a move, though he'd be unlikely to do so without plenty of discussion at lower levels first. But the chain of command can't be accessed midway down and more or less at random. My military colleagues were insulted by what looked, to them, like civilian arrogance and ignorance. Some months later, similar misunderstandings plagued interagency planning on Sudan. With a referendum on South Sudanese independence in the offing, officials at the White House and the State Department were concerned about a resurgence of ethnic violence in the wake of a pro-independence vote. The Defense Department was asked, this time more formally, at the Assistant Secretary, Deputy Assistant Secretary level, to produce plans for preventing or responding to mass atrocities, to give the options in the event of a rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation. Once again, the response from the Pentagon's military planners was to express polite frustration. What assumptions and constraints should guide planning? What kind of plans did the White House want? To respond to what kind of mass atrocities, against whom, and in what likely places? Respond for how long, and through what means, and to what ultimate end? Peace in Sudan? Peace on Earth? Would this mean fighting Sudanese government forces on northern Sudanese soil? Going to war with a foreign and Muslim state? If so, it was hard to imagine the president signing off on such a thing. The United States already had two ongoing wars, and it was a foolish waste of scarce planning resources to prepare for something that was never going to happen. Or maybe the goals were narrower? Should the military be planning to evacuate displaced people? Where to? Should they just focus on protecting a humanitarian corridor? Where? For how long? Was the White House prepared to have boots on the ground with the inevitable risk that events could easily spiral out of control if the troops were attacked? Did they want planning for targeted strikes designed to degrade the military capacity of the bad guys, whoever they might be? Did they even have a theory about who the bad guys would be? The ensuing back and forth was tense and occasionally broke out into open expressions of anger and mistrust. In a sense, it was a civilian-military version of the chicken-and-egg problem. White House staff wanted to be able to give the president a sense of his options. In the event of mass atrocities, what was it realistic for him to consider doing? How complicated, time-consuming, risky, expensive, and effective would it be to protect a humanitarian corridor, as opposed to engaging in limited military strikes to degrade the capacity of those committing atrocities? Without help from military planners, White House staff couldn't properly advise the president. But without political and strategic direction from the White House on how much money they were willing to spend, how many troops they were willing to move, what trade-offs they were willing to make in terms of other ongoing operations, and what would constitute success, military personnel couldn't properly advise their civilian counterparts. Eventually, the issue got semi-resolved. The White House staff was forced to get more specific. The Pentagon was forced to let go of the elaborate planning process it preferred and cough up some back-of-the-envelope assessments. Fortunately for all, the feared genocide in Sudan didn't happen. At the national level, however, the costs of the civilian-military gap are real and high. Such mutual ignorance and such systemic cultural differences in how to think about problems and solutions leads frequently to misunderstanding, inefficient decision-making, and too often, bad policy. There's an irony here. At the senior policy-making level, much of the civilian mistrust of the military derives from an exaggerated estimate of military capabilities. From the outside, the U.S. military appears able to do magic. Get the combat elements of a full division deployed overseas in a single week, see in the dark, eavesdrop on global telecommunications, and fire missiles from invisible unmanned drones that strike only designated individual targets, leaving nearby structures undamaged. Few outsiders understand just how much time, money, and effort lies behind these astonishing capabilities. Indeed, today's military is so specialized and high-tech that even most military personnel understand only a small piece of the puzzle. As a result, civilian leaders often find it difficult to comprehend military claims that a particular task is too difficult, or will take longer than desired, or require more troops or other resources. Mission failure. Take another example of high-level civilian-military misunderstandings. The 2009 debate about troop levels in Afghanistan. As a presidential candidate in 2008, Senator Obama had promised to finish the job in Afghanistan. And in early 2009, the newly inaugurated president got to work. He commissioned a sweeping interagency review of policy in Afghanistan and announced that as an interim measure, he had authorized the deployment of an additional 17,000 troops to Afghanistan in response to a request from General David McKiernan, then the commander of the Afghan theater. By the end of February 2009, the president had adopted the new strategic objectives recommended by his review team, led by diplomat Richard Holbrooke, former CIA official Bruce Rydell, and the Pentagon's Michelle Flournoy, whom the president had appointed as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Henceforth, the United States would seek to disrupt terrorist networks in Afghanistan and Pakistan, thus degrading al-Qaeda and its associates' ability to plan and launch international terrorist attacks. To that end, the U.S. would promote a more capable, accountable, and effective government in Afghanistan and develop increasingly self-reliant Afghan security forces capable of operating with reduced U.S. assistance. These new strategic objectives proved easier to articulate than to achieve. By mid-May, General McKiernan had been ousted from his position, becoming the first of several Afghanistan theater commanders to discover just how elusive finishing the job would turn out to be. McKiernan was succeeded by General Stanley McChrystal, who was in turn assigned the job of undertaking a 60-day review of the situation in Afghanistan, with a view toward determining what course changes might be needed to achieve the president's new strategic objectives. McChrystal completed his review on schedule, but when word spread that he intended to propose a substantial troop increase, rumor put it as high as 70 to 80,000 additional troops, Pentagon officials asked that he hold off on submitting his assessment for several weeks. Even the rumor of such a large troop request had sent waves of dismay through the White House. In any case, it was late summer by then, and everyone from the president on down was taking a vacation. Much behind-the-scenes skirmishing ensued, and in mid-September, a preliminary copy of General McChrystal's assessment was leaked to the Washington Post. Although the leaked version of the report contained no numbers, the bottom line was clear. If the United States did not pour additional resources, including troops, into Afghanistan, McChrystal warned, the likely result would be mission failure. Furious at the leak, which they blamed on the Pentagon, and unwilling to accept McChrystal's gloomy conclusions, senior White House staff engaged in strategic counterleaks. In their version of the story, McChrystal and the Pentagon were trying to box in the president by pushing tens of thousands more troops and refusing to consider other approaches. Eventually, a compromise was reached. 30,000 more troops would be sent to Afghanistan. But the episode left scars. Senior White House officials suspected the military of exaggerating Afghanistan's problems and inflating their estimates of required troop numbers, viewing the military as having a vested interest in continuing a conflict the president had vowed to end. Civilian officials felt manipulated, and less than a year later, General McChrystal was out of a job, forced to resign after a Rolling Stone profile quoted his senior aide speaking mockingly of several senior civilian officials. Of course, the military's take on the 2009 debate about Afghan troop levels was quite different, and it points to the real gulf between the military and its civilian leadership, a gulf that has more to do with differing perceptions of roles and missions than with the near insubordination some White House officials suspected. As one former senior Pentagon official told me, "The military's general stance is, we can do this, but we want you to acknowledge the mess, cost, and complexity." To many in the military, General McChrystal fell victim in 2009 to a White House unwilling to acknowledge any of those things, and equally uninterested in understanding the military's methods, capabilities, or limits. From the Pentagon's perspective, the White House's refusal to accept the costs of its own ambitious Afghan strategy was either naive or hypocritical. After all, the classic model of civilian-military relations holds that it's civilian leaders who set overarching strategic and policy goals, while the job of military leaders is to determine how best to execute those goals. And the White House hadn't asked General McChrystal if he thought the president's strategy in Afghanistan was the right strategy or even a good strategy, or if he thought long-term U.S. interests might be better served by pursuing a radically scaled-down counterterrorism mission, or even by withdrawing U.S. forces altogether. McChrystal was instead told to address a rather narrow question. What military resources were required for the existing strategy to succeed? In response, McChrystal gave an equally narrow answer. To succeed in the mission as defined by the White House, many more troops would be required. If the president wanted a different answer, he needed to ask a different question. Retired Lieutenant General Jim Dubik attributes miscommunications like those that characterized the 2009 debate about Afghanistan troop numbers to the differing models of civil-military relations assumed by military leaders and by the White House. There are several basic models of civil-military relations, he notes. The first is traditional. Civilians and military each occupy semi-autonomous zones. Civilians do policy, the military executes. In this model, the military leaves questions of strategy to the president, but the president leaves the means of carrying out his strategy to military commanders. The second model of civil-military relations is a civilian control model. Civilians are the principals, the bosses, and the military are specialized employees. The military can advise, but they must do what the boss says in the way the boss wants, no more and no less. Here's the problem, says Dubik. Most people in the military still favor the traditional separate spheres model, while most people in the White House tend to think in terms of the employer-employee model. That's a recipe for unhappiness. Of course, he notes there's also a third model available, a functional model in which both sides realize that political leaders make final decisions, but neither has full expertise, so each side needs the other. They have shared responsibilities and need to work together collaboratively. You can't set strategy coherently if you don't understand the challenges of implementation, and it's impossible to implement an incoherent strategy. For the functional model of civil-military relations to work, the military needs permission to engage in strategic discussions, and civilian leaders need some ability to understand and grapple with complex questions of how to make things work. Recently, however, such collaborative civilian-military relationships have proven as elusive as enduring success in Afghanistan. During the 2013 debate about whether to intervene in Syria in response to the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime, another recently retired senior general voiced his frustration with what he saw as lack of coherent strategic guidance from civilian leaders. If war is the continuation of policy, an allusion to Clausewitz's famous maxim, I'd like to know what that policy is, so I can avoid screwing it up or wasting lives for no purpose. We need to know that force has a coherent purpose. Otherwise, it's just killing for killing's sake. In part, he says, military recommendations go unheeded because senior White House staff have come to assume that a risk-averse Pentagon exaggerates every difficulty and inflates every request for troops or money. This assumption can turn every discussion into an antagonistic negotiation session. Sometimes you want to tell them this isn't a political bargaining process, another retired senior military official says ruefully. Where the military comes in high, they counter low, and we settle on an option that splits the difference. Needless to say, the right answer is not always in the middle. Over time, of course, the White House tendency to split the difference creates perverse incentives for military planners, and mutual mistrust becomes self-reinforcing. If you believe the mission truly requires 50,000 troops and $50 billion, but you know that the White House is going to automatically cut every number in half, you'll come in asking for 100,000 troops and $100 billion, says a former White House official. The military eventually starts playing the very game the White House has always suspected them of playing. The stakes of this game are high, says Kathleen Hicks, a former senior Pentagon official. The backdrop today is really tensions over budgets and money. Senior military officials worry that they're being asked to do all these different things, but who will fund it? Who's looking out for the military's institutional interests? Meanwhile, the White House suspects that the military is exaggerating the problems that will be caused by budget cuts, which just makes the military more frustrated. Dial 1-800-MILITARY. All the same, the White House can't do without the military. And for a president who entered office deeply committed to reversing the relentless post-9/11 militarization of U.S. foreign policy, this, in the end, may be what rankles most. After 9/11, resources and authorities flowed to the Pentagon. The Bush administration always wanted military guys between themselves and whatever the problem was, recalls a retired general who served in senior positions during that period, and was more than willing to pour money into the Defense Department. As I noted earlier, it's a vicious circle. As the budgets and capacities of civilian agencies stagnate or decline, the military has stepped into the breach. But the more the military's role expands, the more civilian agencies such as the State Department find themselves sidelined. Until finally, the military becomes virtually the only game in town. And the White House knows it. However committed, in theory at least, to expanding civilian capacity and rebalancing civilian and military roles, President Obama found himself turning again and again to the military in times of crisis, just like so many of his predecessors. When the shit hits the fan, admits a former White House official, the first place we turn is DOD. But this causes resentment among senior military leaders who feel alternately ignored and summoned to the rescue. You have to have an ongoing relationship, says retired Lieutenant General Dave Barno. You can't just dial 1-800-MILITARY when you need them. Welcome to Walmart. Many years ago, when I was in law school, I applied for a summer management consulting job at McKinsey & Company. During one of the interviews, I was asked to respond to a hypothetical business scenario. Imagine you own a small general store. Business is good, but one day you learn that Walmart is about to open a store a block away from you. What do you do? Roll over and die, I said immediately. The interviewer's pursed lips suggested that this was the wrong answer, and no doubt a plucky mom-and-pop operation wouldn't go down without a fight. They'd look for a niche, appeal to neighborhood sentiment, maybe get boutique-y and artisanal, and start serving hand-roasted organic chicory soy lattes seasoned with Aztec spices. But we all know the odds would be against them. When Walmart shows up, the writing is on the wall. With its boundaries and raison d'être increasingly uncertain, the relentlessly expanding U.S. military is becoming, says General Barno, more and more like a super Walmart with everything under one roof. Like Walmart, the military can marshal vast resources and exploit economies of scale in ways impossible for mom-and-pop operations. And like Walmart, the tempting one-stop shopping convenience it offers has a devastating effect on smaller, more traditional enterprises, in this case the State Department and other civilian foreign policy agencies. It's fashionable to despise Walmart for its cheap, tawdry goods, for the human pain we suspect lies at the heart of the enterprise, for its sheer vastness and mindless ubiquity. Most of the time, we prefer not to see it, and use zoning laws to exile its big box stores to the commercial hinterlands, away from the center of town. But much as we resent Walmart, we can't, in the end, seem to live without it. As the military struggles to define its role and mission, it evokes similarly contradictory emotions in its civilian masters. Civilian officials want a military that costs less but provides more, a military that stays deferentially out of strategy discussions but remains eternally available to ride to the rescue. They hate the Pentagon, says a former DOD staffer, but boy do they love it when they're neck deep in crisis. They're racing for that super Walmart every single bloody time. Few senior officers want to preside over the remorseless Walmartization of the U.S. military. They fear that in the end, over-reliance on an expanding military risks destroying not only the civilian competition, but the military itself. They worry that the military, under constant pressure to be all things to all people, could eventually find itself able to offer little of enduring value to anyone. Ultimately, they fear, the military could come to resemble a Walmart after a Black Friday sale, stripped almost bare by a society both greedy for what it can provide and resentful of its dominance, with nothing left behind but some shoddy, mass-produced items strewn haphazardly around the aisles. They have more money. F. Scott Fitzgerald, meticulous chronicler of American social class, famously confided to Ernest Hemingway that the rich are different from the rest of us. Yes, was Hemingway's laconic reply. they have more money. These days, the same could be said of the American military. Is the military different from the rest of us? Yes, it has more money. This is true in a multitude of ways. Start with the obvious. If we view military spending as synonymous with defense spending, which it's not really, but pretend it is for now, boy, does it have more money. In 2011, the total defense budget, including both the base budget and supplemental budgets for overseas contingency operations, for example, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, exceeded $768 billion. Defense spending has gone down since then, mainly because the Iraq and Afghanistan drawdowns caused a reduction in supplemental funding. The defense base budget also dipped for a few years, but has now begun to creep back up again, even in the age of sequestration and during a period in which non-defense discretionary spending has been cut for education, national parks, environmental protection, court operations, scientific research, and the like. In 2014, the Defense Department's base budget hovered a bit over $500 billion, dwarfing most other government accounts. The poor little State Department, for instance, shared a measly $47 billion in base funding with the U.S. Agency for International Development and numerous other international programs. The United States spends more on defense than any other nation. In fact, it accounts for 41% of global defense spending. Annually, we spend almost five times more on defense than China, with its 1.3 billion people, and nine times more than Russia. We spend more on defense each year than the next 15 biggest spenders combined. With its vast budget and complex accounting system, the Pentagon is an infamous money pit. Every couple of years, the Inspector General or the Government Accountability Office discovers that large sums of DOD money have been spent on mysterious, never accounted for purposes. I have noted DOD's difficulty tracking humanitarian assistance projects, but the problem isn't unique to such efforts. DOD's a big place and stuff gets lost. Money, programs, people, organizations, weapon systems, the occasional small war. It's not just from the perspective of national-level budgeting that the military has more money. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the average member of the military is paid better than 75% of civilian federal workers with comparable experience. Members of the military and their families can also lay claim to many of America's most generous, though arguably unsustainable, public sector social programs. As a military spouse, I'm delighted by the range of available benefits. Healthcare? Free. Groceries? Military commissaries save military families roughly 30% over shopping in civilian stores. Education benefits? Career personnel can expect the military to finance additional higher education, and the post-9/11 GI Bill provides up to 36 months of benefits to veterans, amounting, in effect, to full tuition and fees for four academic years transferable to dependents. Housing? Free on-base and subsidized off-base, with a higher housing allowance for personnel with dependents. Anyone who thinks there's no such thing as socialism in America has never spent time on a military base. Pensions are equally generous. After 20 years of service, military personnel can retire and immediately begin to receive, at the ripe old age of 40 or so, an annual pension equal to half their salary for the rest of their lives. Veterans designated as disabled receive additional monthly payments, tax-free. It's a system ripe for reform. In some areas, costs have been spiraling out of control. Healthcare already accounts for about 10% of the defense budget, and DOD spending on healthcare has grown twice as fast as healthcare spending in the civilian sector. In a goofy but illuminating exercise, an analyst at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments concluded that if the defense budget increases only in line with inflation each year, while healthcare costs continue to increase at their current rate, virtually the entire defense budget would go to healthcare costs by 2039. Yet all this money doesn't always translate into higher quality services, faster and better research and development, or rapid and efficient acquisitions processes. Too often, more money just translates into more pork. When I was a newly minted Pentagon employee, one of the things that astounded me most was how hard it was to get Congress to stop funding stupid stuff. This should not have surprised me, since funding stupid stuff is one of Congress's constitutional functions, but it surprised me nonetheless. I recall, for instance, former Defense Secretary Robert Gates's heartburn letters to congressional appropriators. Most of his complaints related not to proposed funding cuts, but to Congress's insistence on giving DOD money for programs the military did not want or need, such as extra VH-71 helicopters or C-17 Globemaster IIIs. Borrowed credibility. Our willingness to throw money at the military, heedless of the need or cost, reflects a deep anxiety about the changing world we live in, combined with a general sense that the military is one of the few remaining functional public institutions. This probably also helps account for another somewhat odd phenomenon, the increased tendency of advocacy groups, on both right and left, to try to associate themselves in some way with the military. Politicians have always vied to demonstrate their love for all things military. For as long as there have been soldiers, there have been politicians eager to stand beside them and soak up a bit of reflected glory. What's more unusual is how eagerly the rest of us have lined up to imitate the candidates. From human rights activists to nutritionists, everyone now seems to look to the military for some borrowed credibility. Take human rights. During the Bush administration, human rights organizations struggled to convince Americans to oppose enhanced interrogation. That's torture when it's at home. In the years immediately following the 9/11 attacks, the American public appeared to have little sympathy for abstract arguments about the rights of suspected terrorists. Searching for a more effective way to change public opinion, Human Rights First assembled a group of retired generals and admirals willing to make the military case against torture. In a letter to President Bush, the group, which included the former commanding general of CENTCOM, asserted that the U.S. use of torture has put American military personnel at greater risk and undermined U.S. intelligence gathering efforts. The group of retired officers assembled by Human Rights First remains active today. It's not just human rights advocates who have sought to enhance their credibility with the American public by associating themselves with the military. With conservatives taking aim at recent efforts to reduce the caloric content of school lunches and public attention waning, healthcare advocates have also brought in the big guns. In their case, a group of senior officers who can frame obesity not as a health problem, but as a military recruitment and readiness problem. In a report called Too Fat to Fight, dozens of retired generals and flag officers proclaimed the obesity epidemic a threat to national security. According to the report, more than a quarter of young Americans are now too fat to qualify for military service. This obviously is bad news for military recruiters, and for the rest of us, too. How can a flabby bunch of couch potatoes defend America as we face off against the third world's lean, hungry masses? Too Fat to Fight goes on to call for the kind of reforms the left generally loves and the right generally hates, such as greater attention to the relationship between poverty, hunger, and obesity, increased federal funding of school lunch programs for the poor, and more government money for the development, testing, and deployment of proven public health interventions. A recent follow-up report, Still Too Fat to Fight, funded by foundations such as the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, called for the elimination of junk food in school vending machines, again in the name of military readiness. The last decade has seen similar efforts to frame everything from climate change to low-quality public education as military issues. And why not? Obesity and poor nutrition surely will hurt military recruitment and readiness, and the U.S. use of torture surely does endanger troops and produces unreliable information. Similarly, low-quality public education threatens military readiness. Illiterate and innumerate recruits are as bad as obese ones, and climate change will certainly cause migration and conflict over resources, creating new challenges for the military. It's more than that, though. In an era in which all military personnel have officially been labeled heroes, former military personnel make fantastic spokespeople for causes that might otherwise languish. After all, polls suggest that Americans have lost faith in virtually every other profession and public institution, and defense budgets have been holding steady or rising even as other discretionary federal budgets drop. Here's what it adds up to. If you want to get something funded in the United States today, you need to find a way to shoehorn it into the defense budget. See Vicious Circle, Walmart. Congress seems increasingly disinclined to fund civilian diplomacy and development initiatives, much less education, environment, and anti-poverty programs. But call something a military problem, and presto, money falls from the heavens. I'm exaggerating, but not by much. As larger and larger swaths of the federal budget fall victim to Jack the Ripper-style cuts, it's the military that increasingly provides the vital services once offered by other parts of the federal government. Little wonder, then, that service members have become a must-have accessory for political candidates and issue advocates. Our cynical political culture devalues social welfare programs and snickers at communitarian impulses, and most of us trust neither our neighbors nor the public institutions that are meant to serve us. The distrust is not unmerited. The more we devalue public programs, the less we fund them, and the less they can offer us, the less we trust them, and so on. The military is all that's left, the last institution standing. No question, there's an element of self-serving jingoism in the efforts of politicians and interest groups to snuggle up with the military, a desire to benefit from a little heroism by association, combined with a shameless appeal to the public's most bellicose and mindless us-versus-them instincts. But perhaps it's more than that. Perhaps we're simply desperate to be reassured that there is an us in the first place, that the United States is something more than simply 300 million people who don't much like or trust one another, and who definitely don't trust their government. Perhaps we try to associate every issue and platform with the military, not because we're self-serving cynics, but because we secretly yearn for a domain that's free of cynicism. The military has come to symbolize those lost American virtues of public-spiritedness, generosity, sacrifice, self-discipline, and service to something larger than the self. It also represents that most elusive of American dreams, a government institution that actually works. Of course, it doesn't always work. Here's another paradox. Today's military is more professionalized and better educated than ever before. Certainly far healthier than most other government institutions, but at the same time it's increasingly hamstrung by its own organizational rigidities. The military has been locked into a defensive crouch, semi-paralyzed by inter-service rivalries, dysfunctional budget politics, and personnel and acquisition systems that seem diabolically designed to discourage creativity and innovation. Virtually every military leader understands that as an institution, the military still lacks many of the core skills and attributes that are essential to addressing today's security challenges. But though military leaders universally proclaim the need for flexibility, adaptability, decentralization, and creativity in today's military personnel, our recruiting system has changed little in the last century. Similarly, military training and education remain focused primarily on skills that are relevant only in a diminishing number of situations. The acquisitions process is cumbersome and slow. Meanwhile, the personnel system makes it difficult to bring in new skills or allow service members to specialize, and a zero-defect internal culture rewards conformity and punishes creativity. In all, as the Defense Science Board declared in a 2010 review, DoD's processes are complex, time-consuming, and often do not align well with the timeframes dictated by today's operational environment. Take just a few examples, starting with recruiting. In some ways, much has changed. 70 years ago, the United States had a segregated military. But today, people of every race, color, and creed train and fight side by side. 25 years ago, women were excluded from half the occupational specialties in the Army and 80% of Marine Corps jobs. Today, women can serve in every military job. Just a few years ago, gay and lesbian service members risked discharge. Today, they can serve openly. But there's one thing that has changed hardly at all. Each year, the overwhelming majority of new military recruits are young and male. In that sense, the American military of 2016 still looks a great deal like the American military of the 1970s, the 1940s, the 1860s, or the 1770s. For that matter, it still looks a lot like virtually every group of warriors in virtually every society during virtually every period of human history. For most of human history, having an army full of young men made sense for two reasons. First, young males are usually stronger, on average, than any other demographic group. They can run fast and carry heavy loads. Second, they're biologically expendable from a species survival perspective. Women of childbearing age are the limiting factor in population growth. A society can lose a lot of young men without a devastating impact on overall population growth. Today, these characteristics don't matter as much as they once did. Overall birth rates are much lower in modern societies than they were during earlier periods, but life expectancy is much longer. Early societies worried about sustaining their populations. Today, we worry less about ensuring population growth than about overburdening the planet's capacity. Simple brawn also offers far less advantage in our high-tech age. In modern warfare, brutal hand-to-hand combat is no longer the norm, and warfare is no longer a matter of sending out wave after wave of troops to overwhelm the enemy through sheer mass. Increasingly, much modern warfare involves a mixture of high-tech skills and low-tech cultural knowledge rather than fighting in the traditional sense. Being young, male, and strong offers no particular advantage to an Air Force remote drone pilot, an Army financial services technician, or a cyber warrior assigned to the NSA. Even for service members in combat positions, the physical strength that young men are more likely to possess no longer offers as much of an advantage. Even the most impressive musculature is no match for an IED. It's not that the physical strength of soldiers has no further military relevance. Notwithstanding all our high-tech gadgets, military personnel, particularly in the infantry, often still find themselves doing things the old-fashioned way, hauling heavy equipment up a winding mountain trail or slugging it out hand-to-hand during a raid. The infantry, along with specialized groups such as the Navy SEALs, will continue to view strength and endurance as essential to their mission. But for increasing numbers of military personnel, the marginal benefits of sheer physical strength and youth have plummeted relative to earlier eras, and this trend seems likely to continue. Meanwhile, an increasing number of tasks we now assign to the military require quite different skills and attributes. Technical experience, scientific know-how, foreign language and regional expertise, an anthropological cast of mind, media savvy, maturity, and good judgment. If military recruiting were better calibrated toward ensuring the mix of skills we need, we might make an effort to recruit far more women, more older personnel, more college graduates, and many more immigrants with unusual language skills. Not everyone will have the physical strength and endurance needed for certain combat jobs, but, as noted earlier, 85% of military personnel serve in non-combat positions. Why not differentiate in recruiting and focus on ensuring a better match between recruits and the positions in which we will need them? We might also look for ways to make it easier for Americans to move back and forth between the military and civilian worlds. At the moment, it's virtually impossible to move laterally into and out of the military. Cybercom's commander can't bring on a dozen top experts from Google for 5-year stints at ranks commensurate with their experience. That's because if a 45-year-old top technical expert at Google wanted to join the military, he'd need an age waiver and would have to start as a first lieutenant with a commensurate salary. This would make it impossible for him to hold positions of authority for years to come. Nor can Cybercom's commander send his 10 brightest young officers off to work in Silicon Valley for a few years. By doing so, they would risk promotions within the military. As it is, many military officers fear that taking broadening assignments will work against them when it comes to promotion and command opportunities. Despite rhetoric from senior military leaders about the value of gaining diverse experiences, it's often those who have followed the straight and narrow path who end up in top positions. The current all-or-nothing approach to military careers doesn't serve the nation well. It keeps talented people out of the military and makes it risky or impossible for military personnel to branch out and still return without career penalties. Granted, there are military positions that require substantive skills that can be gained only by many years in the military itself. Civilian life, no matter how rich and varied, doesn't tend to give people the ability to operate tanks in close formation in a combat setting while coordinating air support. But there are many other military positions for which this is far less true, particularly ones where new skills are needed, be they technical or linguistic. You can't learn combined arms maneuvers in civilian life, but you can learn to be a computer programmer, a medic, an agricultural expert, or an Arabic interpreter. At the moment, the near impossibility of lateral moves between the military and civilian worlds forces an over-reliance on contractors. That's one way to bring in skills, but probably not the best way, and it carries with it risks of its own. During World Wars I and II, the urgent need for officers led the military to grant temporary wartime commissions to lawyers, doctors, and others deemed to possess valuable skills. Those with comparable civilian experience could enter the military at ranks commensurate with their civilian career levels. Today's military urgently needs to experiment with similar flexible programs, both to bring in outside talent and to permit talented military personnel to gain new skills in the civilian world, then return without career penalties. At the same time, the zero-defect nature of military evaluations discourages risk-taking and pushes out many talented officers. Shifting from one occupational specialty to another is difficult, and transcending poor assessments in one area is next to impossible, even if ratings are exceptionally high in other areas. I recall a 3-star general with responsibility for cyber operations lamenting that his most talented aide was likely to be involuntarily separated from the Army because he had a mediocre record as an infantry officer. Despite his talents in the cyber domain, even his 3-star mentor couldn't save the young officer's career. Meanwhile, rigid bureaucratic rules also push out many of the military's best and brightest. Tim Kaine, the author of Bleeding Talent and a vocal critic of the military personnel system, notes that talented senior officers are often badly mismatched with optimal jobs because the Pentagon continues to use a command and control personnel system right out of a Soviet playbook, rather than trusting the voluntary nature of their volunteers. Surveys reveal that the main drivers of attrition are not high op tempo, operational tempo, the pace of new tasks and deployments, but frustration with the personnel bureaucracy. If you speak Korean and want to be stationed in Korea, you may find yourself posted involuntarily to Kuwait, while an Arabic speaker is sent off to Korea. Your kids may have one more year of high school, and your spouse may need one more year to finish her nursing degree at the local university, but none of this matters to the military. You can still be shipped off post-haste to Germany, even though someone else might be better suited to your assignment in any case. You may be an expert in nuclear engineering, but that won't necessarily stop the military from plunking you down in a Pentagon job, where you'll spend your days on counterinsurgency planning. When rigid bureaucracy drives out many talented people, you're left mainly with people who aren't bothered by rigid bureaucracy. But they may not be the right people to lead the military through uncharted waters. In a recent study, Stephen J. Garris and Leonard Wong of the Army War College examined some of the reasons the military is often resistant to change and transformation. They evaluated the degree to which some of the Army's most successful officers exhibited openness, which is manifested in a strong intellectual curiosity, creativity, and a comfortable relationship with novelty and variety. People with low scores on openness tend to have more conventional, traditional interests, preferring familiarity over novelty. They tend to be conservative and resistant to change. Meanwhile, leaders high in openness solicit alternate points of view and are comfortable debating with those whose perspectives differ from their own. They are generally more receptive to change, making them more adept at navigating complex, rapidly changing, and uncertain environments. Senior military personnel didn't score very highly on openness, Garris and Wong found. Personality data gathered at the U.S. Army War College from Lieutenant Colonel and Colonel students show that the most successful officers score lower in openness than the general U.S. population. Upon reflection, this makes sense. People with lower openness scores would probably be more inclined to join the Army in the first place. To make matters worse, though, those Army War College students selected for brigade command, a traditional indicator of success for full colonels, score even lower than the overall Army War College average. This raises an interesting paradox. The leaders recognized and selected by the Army to serve at strategic levels, where uncertainty and complexity are the greatest, tend to have lower levels of one of the attributes most related to success at a strategic level. It's the Peter Principle in action, Army style. The strongest military history of the world. Here's a final paradox, and one that lies at the heart of the high-level civilian-military tensions described in this book. The United States has what President Obama has called the strongest military in the history of the world. But that same military seems increasingly incapable of addressing many of today's most pressing threats. In many ways, the military is a victim of its own success. Our conventional military dominance makes direct challenges nearly suicidal for other states, pushing adversaries toward asymmetric strategies designed to neutralize our strengths and play on our weaknesses. Thus, we handily defeated Saddam Hussein's armies in 1991 and again in 2003, but were caught flat-footed by the rise of terrorism and insurgency inside Iraq and by the challenges of post-conflict stabilization and reconstruction. In Afghanistan, CIA and Special Forces advisors, plus American air power, helped the Northern Alliance gain rapid victory over the Taliban. But top al-Qaeda leaders slipped across the porous Pakistani border. The U.S. occupation helped the Taliban generate new recruits, and our troops were frequently confounded by an invisible enemy that left IEDs in roadways, then melted back into the civilian population. Conventional U.S. military force, designed to combat the militaries of peer and near-peer states, has only limited value when it comes to many of the more distributed and complex challenges we currently face. Tanks and fighter jets can't stop disaffected teenagers in Birmingham or Paris or Detroit from being inspired by al-Qaeda or ISIS. They can't stop ISIS from posting gruesome footage of beheaded hostages on YouTube or halt the spread of Ebola or prevent cyber espionage and attack. Part of the problem is our own false assumptions. I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, Albert Einstein warned President Harry Truman, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. Implied in Einstein's famous adage is an assumption that right up until the moment we knock ourselves back into the Stone Age, the technologies of warfare will evolve in one direction only. They will become ever more advanced, complex, sophisticated, and lethal. Today, much rhetoric about future wars makes this assumption. We assume that military technological innovation is a one-way ratchet. High-tech measures taken by one side will be followed by high-tech countermeasures taken by the other, which will be met with still more advanced countermeasures, and so on, ad infinitum. Or at least until some Einsteinian nuclear catastrophe ends the cycle, crashing us back to the age of sticks and stones. But Einstein's cautionary words overlook one detail. For all our technological sophistication, warfare has never truly moved past sticks and stones. And even today, their bone-breaking power remains surprisingly potent. Certainly, history offers plentiful examples of escalating technological measure-countermeasure-counter-countermeasure cycles. As swords and spears grew more lethal, armor became heavier. As armor became heavier, horses were needed to increase speed and maneuverability, and the invention of the stirrup further increased the lethal effectiveness of mounted cavalry. The development of the longbow and crossbow enabled distance warfare and the decimation of mounted troops armed with swords and spears. But then guns and artillery displaced bows, automatic weapons displaced single-shot weapons, and so on through the atom bomb, for which Einstein's work so ambivalently paved the way. Or consider electronic warfare. During World War II, for instance, Allied forces developed active sonar to locate submerged German U-boats, while ship-based high-frequency radio direction finders were produced to intercept radio transmissions sent by surfaced U-boats. Germany then equipped U-boats with radar detectors, which led the Allies to deploy newly developed centimetric radar, which German radar detectors could not detect. In the context of aerial warfare, the evolution of radar systems to detect incoming aircraft led to the use of chaff and the development of radar jammers, which in turn led to new countermeasures intended to make jamming more difficult, such as frequency hopping and radiation homing. Here's what we seem eager to forget. Military technological evolution can go in both directions. In biological evolution, there's no teleology. The simple doesn't inevitably become more complex. And while life forms change and evolve in response both to random mutation and environmental conditions, they don't inevitably advance. In modern warfare, the same is true. High-tech measures aren't inevitably countered by more high-tech measures. Sometimes the opposite is true. The most successful countermeasures are low-tech, and historically this has been demonstrated just as often as has the opposite. We know this, of course. We just don't like it. Consider most recently the U.S. experience in Afghanistan. The United States brought overwhelming technological superiority to the battlefield, And with it, we also brought new blind spots. The Taliban, a low-budget but by no means low-innovation adversary, quickly developed low-tech responses to our high-tech blind spots. Unable to prevail in direct combat with U.S. troops, for instance, the Taliban turned to improvised explosive devices made of readily available materials and detonated by cell phones. We countered by developing costly vehicle-based cell phone jammers designed to prevent the long-distance detonation of IEDs as our vehicles drove by them. These often had the unintended consequence of disrupting our own communications, and they also led the Taliban to shift to using IEDs with mechanical triggers. We responded by equipping our forces with ground-penetrating radar designed to detect the metallic signature of IED components. The Taliban countered by moving even further in the direction of sticks and stones, constructing pressure-plated IEDs out of foam rubber, plastic, and wood. We've seen similar Taliban low-tech countermeasures in other areas. We have invested heavily in both encryption technologies and surveillance technologies designed to thwart adversaries' use of encryption, for instance. But since we took it for granted that potential adversaries would have made similar high-tech communications commitments, we allowed our ability to locate simple FM radios to degrade. Most of the time, Taliban forces don't bother with encryption. They communicate openly over simple handheld walkie-talkies, using multiple mobile FM repeaters to retransmit these weak signals over longer distances. U.S. forces initially lacked the equipment to intercept these transmissions and reportedly had to rely on purchasing cheap, commercially available radio scanners in the Kabul souk to listen in. The equipment needed to intercept Taliban radio communications became standard, but it has proven far more difficult for us to locate the enemy themselves. We can locate the repeater towers, but not a Taliban soldier on his handheld radio. Al-Qaeda, too, is a learning organization. Threatened by U.S. drones, Al-Qaeda supporters are reportedly turning to low-tech countermeasures, encouraging militants to use mud and grass mats to hide vehicles from overhead surveillance. This tactic won't be successful for long, but it's a good bet that AQ and its offshoots will find new low-tech means to thwart U.S. drones in the coming years. A misplaced confidence in our technological superiority dangerously increases our vulnerability to low-tech countermeasures. In the 1970s, we convinced ourselves that there would be no more Vietnams and turned our backs on whatever wisdom we had gained during that brutal, protracted conflict. Wisdom about the nature of asymmetric and guerrilla warfare, the strength of nationalism, and the perils of occupation. Then, in Iraq and Afghanistan, we painfully relearned many of Vietnam's grim lessons, just in time for the wars to wind down and the public to lose interest. Now, many leaders in both the military and civilian world seem determined to repeat our post-Vietnam head-in-the-sand routine. We won't have any more Iraqs or Afghanistans, we tell ourselves. We won't invade or occupy states or territories with vast ground forces, and we won't be engaged in messy counterinsurgency or stability operations, so we don't need to remember our mistakes. We can just move on. The lessons of Afghanistan will have no applicability to future wars, for these future wars, if any, will be high-tech conflicts with sophisticated state or state-backed adversaries. Maybe so, maybe not. Even if most future wars will be with sophisticated high-tech states, it's a big mistake to imagine that sticks and stones will play no role in future conflicts. After all, it took the Taliban remarkably little time to realize that high-tech U.S. capabilities could frequently be thwarted by lower-tech countermeasures. ISIS has been quick to exploit U.S. over-reliance on high-tech precision weapons as well, and our related refusal to consider boots on the ground. Near-peer states, such as China and Russia, have also taken notice. The Russians have already begun to reshape their strategic assumptions around these changes. In a 2013 article in a Russian military journal, for instance, Valery Gerasimov, Russia's deputy defense minister and chief of the general staff of the armed forces, wrote of the need for his country's military to adapt to this new world. In the 21st century, we have seen a tendency toward blurring the lines between the states of war and peace. Wars are no longer declared, and having begun, proceed according to an unfamiliar template. Gerasimov went on. The very rules of war have changed. The role of non-military means of achieving political and strategic goals has grown, and, in many cases, they have exceeded the power of force of weapons in their effectiveness. From this proceed logical questions. What is modern war? What should the army be prepared for? These days, frontal engagements of large formations of forces at the strategic and operational level are gradually becoming a thing of the past. Long-distance, contactless actions against the enemy are becoming the main means of achieving combat and operational goals. Warfare was once handled exclusively by the armed forces, but conditions have changed. In Ukraine, Russia has already shown an impressive ability to mix the conventional and the unconventional, the high-tech and the low-tech. Russia has relied mainly on proxy forces in Ukraine, arming and advising separatist paramilitary groups. Many of the deaths in Ukraine were due to low-tech tools deployed by separatist groups, arms and simple IEDs. Russia used high-tech jammers to block communications between Ukrainian military units, but also deployed one of the oldest tricks in the book, placing sensitive Russian equipment next to schools and hospitals to make it politically impossible for Ukrainian forces to target them. Russian cyber attacks paralyzed Ukrainian government computers, while crudely doctored photos helped spread anti-Ukraine misinformation. The U.S. military's most thoughtful leaders are taking note as well, and have a keen understanding of the gaps between our current capabilities and the evolving and complex threats we face. The Army's Special Operations Command recently produced a white paper urging greater emphasis on political warfare, for instance, which the paper defined as a persistent and purposeful synergy of diplomatic, economic, informational, and military efforts in unified campaigns where military contributions support the attainment of broader strategic end states. The logic behind this is much like that behind emerging Chinese and Russian military strategies. Rather than a binary opposition between war and peace, the conduct of international relations is characterized by continuously evolving combinations of collaboration, conciliation, confrontation, and conflict. As such, during times of interstate peace, the U.S. government must still confront adversaries aggressively and conclusively through all means of national power. When those adversaries practice a form of hybrid warfare employing political, military, economic, and criminal tools below the threshold of conventional warfare, the U.S. must overmatch adversary efforts. Sounds simple on paper. If our adversaries seamlessly blend diplomacy, economic power, media and information campaigns, and so on, making full, though often covert, use both of traditional state and military tools and of the private sector, the United States will need to learn to do the same. But it's relatively simple for authoritarian regimes to coordinate all means of national power. Authoritarian and totalitarian regimes don't need to bother with domestic legal restrictions, and private citizens can be coerced into doing the state's bidding. It's not so easy for a democracy, at least not for a democracy that hopes to stay that way. Part 5. Managing War's Paradoxes. On the morning of September 11, 2001, I was driving to work from my home in rural Free Union, Virginia. I was 6 months pregnant with my first child and in my first semester teaching at the University of Virginia School of Law. I didn't want to be late for my criminal law class. As I drove through the rolling foothills of the Blue Ridge, I turned on the radio. It was a few minutes before nine. The voices on the radio were talking about the World Trade Center and a crash and a fire. I frowned. Why was the World Trade Center on the news? I wondered if they were doing some sort of retrospective on the 1993 truck bomb attack, which had killed 6 people. And I almost changed the station. I wasn't interested in a nearly 10-year-old story. But then there was something about a plane flying into a tower, and I realized that this was breaking news. An accident, maybe? A few minutes later, one of the voices said something about a second plane hitting the other tower. By now, the news anchors were beginning to sound flustered. Could it be a terrorist attack, they wondered? Or just a coincidence? I snorted. 2 planes hitting the Twin Towers within 20 minutes? A coincidence didn't seem likely. Arriving at work, I found several colleagues standing around. No one seemed to know what to do. One woman was sobbing. Her daughter was in New York and she couldn't reach her. All the phone lines were tied up. Someone hugged her awkwardly and we all stood around some more. Suddenly, someone shouted from inside an office, "The tower is collapsing!" We all raced in to stare dumbstruck at his computer, but the screen only showed streets full of thick smoke. A few minutes later, the university canceled classes and I went home. We had only moved to Virginia the previous month, and we hadn't yet purchased a television. This seemed as good a time as any to acquire one, so my then-husband and I drove to Best Buy. But walking into the store, it was clear right away that no one would be doing any buying or selling today. The employees were all clustered toward the rear of the store, where they stood gaping at